Welcome to the Passive Mobile Home Park Investing Podcast with your host, Andrew Keel. This is the podcast where you can get the education you need to invest 100% passively in the highly profitable niche of mobile home parks.
Welcome to the Passive Mobile Home Park Investing Podcast. This is your host, Andrew Keel, and today we have an exciting episode with a very special guest, Mr. Mike Neasley from Colliers Manufactured Housing and RV Group. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Thank you very much, Andrew. Appreciate the time spending with me.
Yeah. To dive in and give a little background on Mike, he's the founding member of the Manufactured Housing and RV Group at Colliers, where he serves as vice chair and national director with over $100 billion in commercial real estate transactions under his belt. That's billion with a B. Mike's experience spans sales, consulting, valuation, financing, and appraisals for major names like Parkbridge, Keystone, Carlisle, Sun Communities, RHP, ELS, Inspire, Yes Communities, and I could keep going. There's more on this list here, but Mike is definitely a veteran in the space. Most recently, Mike closed a 24-property Canadian manufactured housing community portfolio that sold at nearly $200 million, which was the second largest Canadian manufactured home / RV resort portfolio acquisition for a large Canadian pension fund. And also in 2022 and in 2023, Mike closed $114 million and $86 million mobile home community portfolio in Central Florida. So Mike, excited to dive in and kind of get your perspective. Would you mind maybe just starting out by telling, you know, our listeners a little about how you got started in manufactured housing?
Yes. Yeah. It's interesting. You know, my family got into the business in the early 80s, and they were buying small mobile home parks and out of the Tampa Bay, Florida area. And so I was in school at the time. But my grandfather used to drive me through the parks and tell me what they were doing. You know, he was more of the money, but he wasn't the operator, but he was proud of his venture. He was a retired Wall Street investment banker. So he would drive me through. And then, you know, then after I graduated from college, you know, they had accumulated a, you know, nice little portfolio. And my grandfather had died, you know, fairly, I can't remember the exact year, but he had died. And then my uncle had taken over the family business. And then I think it was 1999 or 98, my uncle died. And then my grandmother tapped me on the shoulder and said, I need your help. And so I was working for one of those dot-com companies in Miami. And so I just dropped everything and went into the business and, you know, had to learn everything because I wasn't, you know, I didn't know anything. So I met some, you know, key people at the beginning. People like names that you've heard in the business, like the Newbie family, the Newbie management.
Yeah,
they were one of my first contacts. George Allen, and some of you know, some of the other kind of founders of the industry, and so they introduced me to other good people that got me educated, and so that was the beginning of all of it. But I had to learn about my family's portfolio. We had a partner, and so I had to learn about the operations and financing and everything and acquisitions and personnel and just, you know, all the, you know, park owned units and rehab and all that stuff. And so, you know, the family member that was the owners was my grandmother, and she, you know, she was the boss, and but she was, you know, passive. And so I was sort of representing the family's interest. And so it was just a great start and a great opportunity to learn. You know, pretty early on, I decided that it wasn't going to work for various reasons. And so I ended up, there's friends of mine in the business that were like, hey, why don't you just do what you're doing and just, you know, be a broker and come over to our firm. And so someone at Grubb & Ellis recruited me, and I came to Grubb & Ellis, started their group, and everybody laughed at what I did and said, ha ha, mobile home parks. And so I got all the, you know, typical kind of teasing about the asset class because everybody else was doing all kinds of fancy stuff where they could dress up, and I was doing the other stuff. And so maybe 18 months later, still made nothing, finally started closing deals like shortly after. my wife was, you know, along the way, was like, are we making a good move here? You know, we left a for sure thing for this. And so, you know, eventually deals started closing and started, you know, things started working. And then year three, four, five, I became like the top producer at Grubb & Ellis in Florida for all of those 3 years. And then maybe one or two of the years, I was in the top 50 of the whole company. It was, at the time, was one of the biggest companies, public companies. And so that was fun. And it, you know, it happened fairly quickly. And I was married with three or four kids at the time. So I was a little bit, you know, I wasn't like a 21-year-old that started. I was probably 30 something. And so I had a lot of responsibility, but it felt good to have that success. And, you know, met a lot of people in the industry in the early days, some of the people that are like legends now. And so saw them when they were starting off and humble. And so it was a great experience. And then, so towards the end of my years at Grubb & Ellis, I started looking around because people started calling me and they heard about what I was doing. And so some of the big firms were all interested because none of them were in. The only other firm that was in it was Millichap. And Millichap was like...
Just to pause there. So they didn't have an MH division, like a manufactured housing division at all.
Yeah.
They were none office. Of them, yeah. They were more, you know, multifamily, more traditional.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and then it was just all the little independent brokers. So it was really, it was sort of the beginning of institutional brokerage. So I sort of, I made the jump from Grubb & Ellis to CBRE, which is the biggest, you know, most well-known firm in the world. And so I said, wow, this is going to be exciting. A few people, I talked to people and I had offers from other groups that were, you know, good offers. And I was like, wow, this is pretty cool. Sign-on bonus, all kinds of stuff. And so, but I just thought CBRE gave me a big platform to leverage. And so I made the jump to CBRE, started the group there, hired people, you know, got a, you know, nice large team around the country and had a lot of success. You know, my expectations were I want to see what the biggest deals are and the most sophisticated firm. And, you know, and so I think it fulfilled all those, you know, those goals and objectives. And then after about 10 years or so there, I'd been trying to recruit Bruce Nell, who works for Colliers. He's the top appraiser in the world and for MH and RV. And so we couldn't get anything done at CBRE. So then, you know, Bruce was like, why don't you come over here? And so, and there were some things going on at CBRE, some changes that were going on that, you know, maybe weren't as appealing to me. And so, I went with Bruce to CBRE, started the group there, and he had been already doing the appraisal work. And so I started the brokerage platform and the debt platform. And I've been at Colliers for maybe 7 years or 8 years and built a great team here and some of the best guys in the industry. Richard Knapp on my team from Carlisle and Blackstone and Wharton grad, super smart, one of the best underwriters in the industry. Michael Barnett, University of Miami grad, works for Richard, and Carrie Pell, a Wells Fargo alumni, and she's great out of Charlotte. So they're scattered around the country. And then I've got some of the most experienced brokers that were also owner operators in the Tampa Bay area, Bill Haldane, who's, you know, him and his brother have had a big portfolio and throughout the years. And so it's invaluable to have someone with that experience because you've got, you know, they've done all the work, you know, they've done all the things that you do every day and they've, you know, the good and the bad. And so when you're advising a client, having that experience, it's not just a spreadsheet. It's a lot more than that. Yeah. So I think that, you know, having the people on my team that have operational and some more depth, I think is super important as an advisor. So, and then we've got a marketing team headed by Ashley out of Austin, Texas, and Chris Clay, who's been with me for many years, is he does debt and he's also been one of the leading brokers. And so he was with me at CBRE and came over to Colliers as well. So, no, we just have a very strong team. And Kristen Nisley, my daughter, does public relations for us. David Nisley does brokerage and marketing. And so, but we've got, and we've got, you know, teams. Colliers has like the top team in the UK that specializes in mobile and RV. So in Australia, we used to have the top team and they got recruited by one of the big operators in Australia. So We still have people that work there, but they're being gobbled up by some of the operators.
And we don't hear much about that, right? The global MH platform, that there are caravan parks and mobile home trailer parks in other countries. That's interesting. Yeah. How much do you have your hands on, you know, in that business?
Well, it's very interesting. So when my family started, we couldn't get a loan for a park. None of the banks were really liking that type of loan. So the first 10 deals we bought, seller financing, right? And so like there's a long path since then that's institutionalized the asset class, MH in particular, and RV is moving in that direction as well. But now you got Fannie Freddie and all the banks and insurance companies. And so it's a very well understood asset class, stable, one of the best, and it's performed the best, you know, probably over a long period of any other. So, you know, so anyway, it's evolved, and that's and so the global asset class has always been there, but it's always been locally owned, and it really hasn't left its neighborhood as far as cross-border investment. There hasn't been very much. But in the last probably, you know, 10 years or less, it's really accelerated. And so you've got US people investing in Australia and UK and, you know, broader Europe and Canada. And then you've got, you know, Canadians in the US. There's a lot of Canadian pension funds that are funding US MHC. You've got UK investing in the US. I mean, and you've got private equity that sort of has their fingers in all of it globally. And so it's just pension funds are they like the asset class because it's a safe asset class. It sort of follows the demographic bubble of senior and affordable. And so those are the two, you know, great bubbles to invest in. And so I think they're smart, long-term investors. And so they've identified this asset class as one of the best.
I know you work a lot with institutional investors, mm-hmm. right? The pension funds and other big REITs and so forth.
Yeah.
So how would you say they look at the asset class different than, you know, maybe some other mom and pops or, you know, more smaller operators like myself, right? We own, you know, quite a few communities, but, you know, 3,000 lots, but we're small potatoes compared to ELS and some of these other big operators, right?
I think all of them started humble the same way you did. All of them, Sam Zell, all of them. But as they evolved, they started buying larger and having more economies of scale and refining the quality. So I think it's a normal evolution. When you start off in anything, your entry point might be, you know, the subpar, you know, 2-star parks. And that's where you enter. You get the highest yield. And then as you harvest your profits, you step up and get the nicer assets and that are more passive. And as you know, you don't want to work as hard and you don't want to struggle through so much CapEx and park-owned units and all the things you got to do at the beginning. And so then you evolve into more passive. But I think, you know, those guys are already there. Money is less of a constraint. The individuals are always, you know, looking to get good financing. You know, RV is probably, you know, more of a challenge than MH. But I think it's still, you know, when they've got the lowest cost of capital and sort of unlimited capital, I think they have a big advantage and they think about it, their investments differently.
And maybe you can touch a little bit on that. Like what features of a mobile home park itself make it institutional quality?
I mean, you know, the typical things that people, you know, have said over the years have been 200 plus sites, public water and sewer and good MSAs and those type of things. But I think as the supply, you know, gets gobbled up and more institutionalized and consolidated, I think the larger owner operators are willing to sort of buy smaller and maybe more tertiary than they were just because it's supply constrained. We're not building enough parks to keep up with the demand. And so therefore, if you want to keep buying in the asset class, you probably got to buy smaller. And there's been, you know, we had some recent trades where the average deal size within the portfolio was maybe 50 to 75, but 2,000 lots and all clustered where they operate efficiently, You know, it's sort of, you're buying zip codes rather than worrying about how many units are in the park. So I think that's a different way of doing it, but it's also addressing maybe the difficulty to compete with some of the institutional investors. So I think economies of scale can be achieved in other ways.
Definitely. And then let's talk more, about the sales side, right? And like, mm-hmm. What would you say are like the essential steps that you take in evaluating a mobile home park? You know, you and your underwriting team, your time in the space, what specifically do you look at to determine value and what matters most, obviously besides the income that it's generating?
Yeah. So generally we're representing sellers majority of the time. And so sort of our mission has been to help the mom and pop sellers with, when we're even institutionals as well, or family office but they need help. And they're really good at managing, operating the day to day, but they may not be in the selling business. So it's like a different business than operating a park, right? So when you're buying, it's one game. And when you're operating, it's another game. When you're selling, it's another game. So we understand the selling game really well. And so what we try to do is help them, because I think that, they're often at a disadvantage and they're, not maybe underrepresented. And so we're trying to make sure that they get a fair deal. There's been, a bunch of stories where people, didn't get a fair deal, and it's their sort of their one shot in life to cash out. And so it's a sad story when you hear about that, and they weren't represented, or, they wanted to avoid paying a commission, but they lost $5 million instead of paying, $200,000 in commission. So I think it's a good deed to help the sellers with that process and to make sure that it's truly a market deal. And that's what we try to accomplish. And so just starting off with, the very basics, and depending on the sellers and their level of sophistication, there's some basic things, right? Sometimes they've got things in their expenses that are CapEx, or just things that don't belong there that are understating the NOI because their financials they provide us are for the purpose of minimizing taxes, not for selling. And so we often have to help them with, with those basics. But then you'd be surprised, the larger guys are also, for whatever reason, they're so big and so, they're just machines, and maybe they're leaving something on the table as well. And so, we recently, we have a very large transaction that's closing in the fourth quarter, and $750 million, and a big institutional owner that had some major things that we identified that were just and it wasn't really on the financial side, but it was on the operational side, and it was not like heavy lift operational. It was just like stuff that they weren't doing, and they're sort of in a different business. It's not their primary business. So we helped them, and we created significant value we identified 6 or 7 of the major upside pieces there that allowed them to allowed us to articulate what the opportunity really was. And it wasn't just the NOI. So
that's the piece, right? Is like telling the story, right? It's not just the NOI. It's, hey, this is a large buyer. This is not their main competency. They got in here, and maybe their management expenses are, double the average, management expense, right? Because they don't have a big enough portfolio to have the scale they need to have enough people. So they have higher management fees. And then you come in and say, hey, when you're selling that to a new buyer, you say, hey, this is really supposed to be about, 3 to 4% of gross, not, 10% of gross. Is that the kind of stuff you're talking about?
I mean, we go through every line item, and there's, and not everything falls within a certain range because different properties operate differently and they've got different characteristics. But, we sort of have a good feel of where payroll should be, and we have a good feel. And so one of the things that we run into with some of the mom and pop operators, and maybe in particular in the RV space, we may have, a family that's all been working for a long time there and may have like a payroll that's off the chart, $1 million payroll. And you know, it doesn't, it probably needs to be two-thirds or a third of that, right? Two-thirds should be cut off. And so sometimes we have to like almost argue with them on why we need to present it in the proper way, because they're just running way heavy. And they're like, oh, I don't know if you can do that. But, you know, but again, eventually they understand, because the day after closing, the buyer is going to cut all of that. And so they're basically gifting the buyer a lot of money. So we try to, you know, we try to, within reason, we're not, you know, trying to overprice things, but we want to make sure it's a fair deal and that everything's being looked at. And so we take that job of representing our sellers seriously. And some of the people listening are like buyers and they're like, oh my gosh, you know, but someday they'll be sellers. And then, you know, they'll probably want to talk to me because I'm not just introducing you to my friend. I'm running a full process. And so not only do we get to the value and underwrite it properly, and we also expose it to a huge, you know, audience, and to make sure there's, you know, plenty of the market participants making offers, and there's a competitive process.
What, talk about park-owned homes, you know, do institutional buyers add value to those? You know, how are they valuing them? You know, I know, like, I think it's UMH or RH. No, I think it's UMH. They have like a large, you know, street rental communities. I went to one of them that was like the community of the year in Memphis, Blues, I think it's called. And it was beautiful. They like scrapped the whole park from what it was and just brought in all new homes, all new roads, all new everything. And they're all street rentals. Maybe you can talk about that for a minute, you know, just how they look at park-owned homes and kind of, you know, maybe how your opinion on park-owned homes has changed or hasn't.
Yeah. When we started, we had a very high percentage of park-owned units, my family. And as, you know, over time, we became more passive and sold them to the residents and just tried to stick to mostly lot rent. And I think that most people evolve to that. There are some operators that do a great job at park-owned units. And so, and, but it's a, you know, hands-on business. It's more like an apartment. And, but the revenue is very attractive. If you can manage the expense side, CapEx and turnover, then I think it's, you know, it's a good business, but it's, you got to work for it. So, but I think that some people do it very well. I would say majority of the people are looking at park-owned units and they're, you know, the goal is to sell them off at some point.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's probably for the financing benefits, right? Agency, they want to see you with a lower percentage of park-owned homes and they'll give you better terms, you know, accordingly. So.
Yeah. And management intensity, right? I mean, I think just managing park-owned units is not necessarily easy. And if you don't pay attention for a little while, it can sort of spin out of control quickly. So, and it's capital intensive. And so, some of the investors are, you know, they're syndicators. And so, you know, going back to their investors and asking for more money because they got behind on park-owned units never is, you know, popular. And so, I think when you don't have those, then you reduce the amount of potential capital call situations.
Totally. Mike, what has been the most challenging mobile home park property that you've ever sold during your career and why?
I mean, there's lots of challenging ones, but I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of them. It's just some of them are overpriced. Some of them have all kinds of dynamics. There's probably some entertaining stories, but I think that I don't want to call out any individual properties. I'll get in trouble somehow.
Due diligence? Because like, you know, we wholesale some parks. Mm-hmm. And not many, but like, you know, we have a sales team for our own acquisition funnel. If one, you know, we've come across something that doesn't quite meet our criteria for some reason, we'll wholesale it. And I would say, and we also wholesaled some self-storage stuff. Mm-hmm. I would say the self-storage stuff, we sell probably 9 out of 10 deals that we send out. The mobile home parks, we'll get 9 out of 10 under contract to sell them, but then half of them fall out in due diligence. Because, you know, you're talking about 50 plus year old utility infrastructure. And, you know, if you want to find something, you can find something, you know, to get scared of. So, I'm sure as a broker, there's a little more variability there, right? To like the deals that get done.
100%. I mean, I don't know a lot about the assignment business, but I could imagine that the level of due diligence that you do on assignment versus something you're going all the way to the finish line with will probably be a little less. So then probably the risk on that transaction would be a little bit higher for you guys and for the buyer, because they don't fully know what they've got. They've got to do a full due diligence. So, right. So I think that's probably, with a self-storage, there's probably less variables to be concerned with. And so I can see that. I think, you know, during the last, I don't know, 3 years since rates have gone, and we've seen this happen in other times, in 2008, there's, you know, the economy and rates and banks. I think that sort of makes the overall business hard. I don't know, individual properties, there's a million stories of sewer and, you know, somebody hiding money or just all that kind of stuff. And we've seen all that through the years. But I do think that in this current market, just the disconnect between the buyer and seller and value, just because of rates, it made, you know, everything come to a halt for a while. And I think now we're starting to see a little bit of movement in the right direction. At least Canada's lowered the rates two or three times, and looks like US is ready to do it sometime soon, or after the election, sometime soon. But anyway, people are a little bit more optimistic now, and I think people are starting to transact more, and pricing is maybe getting closer. Buyer and seller are getting closer to consensus.
Maybe. Yeah. Spoken like a true broker. We're maybe getting closer, right?
Well, no, there's more. There's more that are
they're transacting.
Yeah.
Sellers are realizing, hey, you know, we got to do something if we want to get this thing sold, right? Mike, what do you think is the toughest hurdle that like people need to overcome when it comes to mobile home park investing? Like what, like the normal operator, what's the toughest hurdle that they have to, like if it's a newbie and they're going out to buy their first park, you know, what's the biggest hurdles that they're stepping into that they might not be aware of?
I mean, I just think some of the people that we worked with started off maybe too aggressively buying something that was a really big heavy lift, and they got themselves, you know, way over their skis early on, and it sort of hurt their momentum. And I know some other guys that sort of bought some basic deals that not too crazy and then built slowly and then, you know, got comfortable with more value add or, you know, could take on some things along the way. So I think getting off to that good start, I think, is helpful, because then you build confidence in your capital, and your capital wants to give you more, and then it works. But if you have a couple difficult ones at the beginning, then raising money gets harder. And so I think that I've seen, you know, a lot of people through the years start up, and, you know, and I think most of the wise ones are just trying to get like a vanilla deal to start with and just get the ball rolling, build a team where you have excellence on your team and accounting and reporting and operations. And because initially, you know, probably when you started, you had to do it all yourself, right?
Totally. Yeah. No, I think that's great advice, Mike. It's like Frank Rolf says at his boot camps, he's like, hey, for your first park, just buy a park with, you know, city water and city sewer.
Exactly.
Don't go buy a lagoon your first park. Don't go buy a wastewater treatment plant your first park. Go for a solid base hit, and then, you know, you can build up some momentum. I think that's like some of the best advice on this podcast, because I've seen it time and time again, like you said, where people go in, they bite off this huge infill project because the numbers look really good on the spreadsheet, right? Yeah. If you can fill every lot for $25,000 and lot rents are $500 a month, it looks really great. But if you run out of money, or like a park we just looked at, 125 lots, 82 occupied, went and looked at it, looked good from afar. You get on site, all of the concrete pads have like erosion underneath of them. So the community's not allowing any homes to go in on all these vacant pads because like they're eroding, like the pads have cracks in them. They're about to, you know, because it was built, you know, the foundation wasn't set properly. So, you know, I think that kind of carries into my next question, you know, due diligence and the importance of that. And, you know, what would you say are like some key things that people need to look at in due diligence right away?
Yeah, I just think, you know, the obvious things are park-owned units, and sometimes it doesn't show up as park-owned units. Sometimes it shows up as notes where it shows up as a private owner that owns, you know, 10, 20, 50 homes, you know, within the community, or where it's titled and it's somehow related to the owner. So those things are always, you want to understand those and the complications that come with, you know, getting the title and getting control of your community if you're going to buy it. Water, sewer, roads, electric, right? Park-owned unit CapEx, right? Those are all the big CapEx items. So making sure all those things are you know, not, you know, not ignored or missed. That we, a couple times we, when my family was buying early on, there was, you know, a sewer permit on a private sewer that was coming up, and we didn't really give it weight on how that was important and what the ripple effect could be. So sewer permit came and the DEP came and they said, oh, you know, you've got to upgrade your retention pond. You got to, that costs a lot of, you know, unknown CapEx, unexpected CapEx. And then the ponds were not percolating. So then we were in, you know, trouble there too. So I think that just besides, you know, you got to know the condition of the plant. You got to know what the regulatory bodies may ask you to do when that permit comes up. Because I think that's something, if it's 2 years away, you still got to look at it. Because even though you don't have to spend money day one, you know, in year two, you may need to spend that money. And there's, you know, certain areas are getting more strict on and water and sewer plants, and they keep on requiring a higher level of CapEx. So I think those things, and, you know, I think some people don't really appreciate the electrical side too, because there's always, you know, people have rigged some of their things, and if you don't really hire a professional, you may not see it. And so we have people that are, you know, the electric's shared between multiple units, and the breakers are always going off, and it's like probably a safety hazard for fires and stuff. So I think that's always, you know, so I think that people should not try to save money and go cheap on CapEx, because it'll cost you later.
Cost you in the long run.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
That's good. What mistakes have you made, Mike, in, you know, mobile home park investing that we could learn from?
Sewer, that sewer situation. I'm trying to think of what else. I think just early on, I think on the spreadsheet, the park owned units just looked very enticing. So I think that it looked good, but when you had to actually do the work and really, you know, stay on it, I think it was more difficult than anyone anticipated. And yeah, so I don't want to elaborate too much on that. There's some very colorful examples that Frank Rolf usually tells in his seminars, but park-owned unit just adds a lot of management intensity and the CapEx required, and getting the CapEx done in a timely fashion so you can get it rented again it's just a lot more involvement than should be necessary.
And like you were talking about earlier, at scale, right, that only compounds the issue, right? And 100%. A lot of people, I've said this before, but a lot of people don't realize that, you know, manufactured homes, the windows are different sizes, the doors are different sizes, the drywall is a different size. You can't just go to Home Depot and get this stuff. You have to special order it if you want to do it the right way. And so that adds a layer of complexity to renovating these units and the costs involved. So good insight there, Mike. Going to go into a little lightning round here. Just four quick questions, and you just fire off what comes to your mind first. All right.
Sure.
If you were going to invest passively as a limited partner into a mobile home park deal, what are the things you would look at in the deal?
Passively LP, I would look for large, high quality in a growing market. So, you know, in some of the, you know, high population and job growth markets, if it's MH, if it's RV, it may be more, a little different, more destination oriented, but, you know, Texas, Florida, Southeast, all these fast growing states where everybody's moving for jobs and for climate. I think those are, you know, the winds at your back. And so you can make mistakes, and it's more forgiving if you're in some of the other states with the population growth and, you know, job growth and rent growth is lower. So all those things are harder to cover up mistakes. So it's good to, you know, so I like those places. And so if I'm an LP investor, then whoever the GP is and the operator, I'd probably less likely they're going to make a mistake and my money will be safe.
Yeah. No, it's always nice to have the wind at your back. That's for sure. Yeah. And I started out in tertiary, you know, Midwestern mm-hmm. markets, did well, you know, the value add kind of hustle. But as we mature in our kind of buying criteria, we're looking at better markets, higher median home prices. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, it's just a, yeah, it's nice to have that, you know, maybe a little bit more rent growth than you planned on is always nice. So that's good.
I think as you get older, you want to be more passive. I think that's everybody in the industry that I know is kind of in that direction, just because, you know, it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work when you have the less passive investments and tertiary, you get a hustle. And I think that, you know, as you get older, you probably established and created some wealth and success. And so it's time to sort of change the profile.
Yeah. Have more reliable, you know, less turnover, that kind of stuff matters quite a bit for sure.
Yeah.
Mike, what do you think the perfect mobile home park looks like in your eyes and why?
Wow. I think that, you know, senior parks in places like Arizona and Florida are, you've got a lot of wealth in those two areas that are coming from, you know, the New York or the Northeast wealth, and you've got California and, you know, West Coast wealth going to Arizona and some Canadian wealth going to Arizona. So I think those two states are sort of probably the gold standard in investing. I think there's lots of other good states, but those two have traditionally been highly desired by all the institutional guys for those reasons, because disposable income and, you know, and high housing prices and that type of thing always work in your favor.
That's huge. Yeah. My wife's aunt lives in an all double wide community in Huntington Beach and in California. And literally she said, we don't want to live anywhere else. This is the place is immaculate. You know, it has like a pool. It has all of that. And they're walking distance to like the downtown strip where all the restaurants and, you know, the pier is. And it's like, that is such a high quality life, right? Your lifestyle is just so great. And it's a different, you know, a different type of park, right? Than what people assume when they think of, you know, mobile home park or trailer park. They don't even know, like there's such high quality assets out there like that in great locations.
And if there's not rent control, that's sort of changing the profile of the investment, but you just have the, you know, the gap between the cost and the affordability issues, just such a positive thing in some of those high rent, high sales markets that, you know, as long as rent control is not too restricting, I think it's great. Even, you know, California has some great parks and you just learn how to play that game, I think.
Yeah.
And those owners have learned how to do it. And some of the people from the East are like, I'd never invest in California, but the people that own there, they love it.
They love it. Yeah. They still transact at pennies because of, you know, if you know how to play the game, because I think it's something like if you invest a certain amount of CapEx, then you can go above the expectation. Exactly. And so there's definitely a good game there. Mike, what do you think the biggest threat to mobile home park investing is?
Yeah. So I think, you know, rent control, I think, you know, regulation, rent control hurts it. I think that, you know, I think that most of the time when they put these things in place, there's just like every regulation, there's always loopholes and there's always the smart guys who figure it out. But I think it puts a little bit of a damper on it. If everything was rent control in the US, it wouldn't be as attractive as it is. Mm-hmm. But I do think one of the other things is, you know, there's not enough development going on right now. So I think that the aging of the existing communities is, you know, you've got a lot of them were built in the 70s and 80s and they're, you know, past their useful life. So, you know, and we're not rebuilding enough to replace them. And as the urban core keeps growing out and out, we need to build in those, you know, right on the edge of the urban core. And that's kind of, you know, we need more development. And I think financing for development, I think there's been little booms through the years, but nothing like it was back then. So I think that efficient financing for construction and for the homes themselves will pave the way. So I think if we had Fannie Freddie that was financing the homes, then that would be a game changer.
Huge. Yeah. I talked to one mom and pop and they said that they were able to build their park back in like the 50s or 60s, they were to build it with a government loan. I don't know if it was HUD or agency. They were able to build their park with 3% down. So 97% loan from the government to build the mobile home park.
Yep.
And they built it out in phases. So we need something like that to get more of this happening. But I think the zoning restrictions are just super prohibitive right now. So
I mean, zoning in any of the urban centers they're gonna say no. So then that means you're gonna be pushed out into outside the urban service boundaries, which means private utilities.
Yeah.
Right. So that's the new growth. We'll have probably private utilities. If you don't have the zoning problems there, you'll have the utility problems. But I think there still needs to be. And so I think that's the threat. If it's too difficult to develop, then I think the industry, you know, there's not enough supply and there's so many people getting into this great asset class that they may go look elsewhere.
Yeah.
Because storage, they have more construction. Even RV probably has more construction than MH.
Yeah.
And all the other asset classes, they're adding supply to hotels and apartments, and maybe not office buildings right now, but you know, traditionally through the years, all the other asset classes have had a supply, you know, they've been steady supply of new product. I think it's a good thing for our industry to have constricted supply, because that ensures that if you own something, you're in good shape and not going to build next door and, you know, dilute you. But I do think if we don't build more, it'll cause a problem eventually.
Yeah. I heard this threat yesterday from a friend of mine, and I'm curious your thoughts on it, because you've been through multiple cycles, 2008, right? Like all of that. Yeah. But he said, you know, artificial intelligence, he fears, is going to displace a lot of the low income workers, you know, factory manufacturing jobs. And over the next 15 years, you know, they will have trouble finding, you know, more consistent employment potentially. And any worries that could hinder the asset class's ability to, you know, consistently, you know, keep up with their occupancy and everything. So what are your thoughts?
Man, that's above my pay grade, but I do think that, you know, some of those demographic shifts are going to have an impact on all housing. And then the fact that we're providing the lowest cost housing is probably a good place to be no matter what happens, because the guy that's in a $500,000 house may downgrade to a manufactured home because his circumstances change. So we're probably in the safest place.
Yeah. Well, dude, thank you so much for coming on, Mike. This has been fantastic. Yeah. If any of our listeners would like to get a hold of you, Mike, or check out the Colliers platform, you know, for MH and RV, what's the best way for them to get a hold of you?
Okay. Somebody told me a generic one, but I'll just give you mine because I don't remember the other ones. So mike.nisley@colliers.com. And my phone number is 561-479-1588.
Awesome. And we'll put that in the show notes. And you're based out of Boca, correct?
Boca Raton, Florida. Yes.
Awesome. Fantastic.
And we cover the whole country. We cover North America. I've got team members all around the country.
That's fantastic. One last question. What's one last bit of important advice you would give an interested passive mobile home park investor before we sign off?
Wow. Make sure you have a good operator that you partner with, right? If you're equity that's looking to invest, rather than do it yourself, partner up with someone early on to avoid those missteps and, you know, keep your money safe. And then later on, if you feel more confident, then you can go off on your own. But I think you need a good operator to partner with. I think that'll ensure that your first experience is more positive.
That's great, Mike. Well, thanks again for coming on the show. That's it for today, folks. Reminder, if you got any value out of this show, which there was a lot of golden nuggets, if you got any value, please leave the show a review. That helps us, you know, get more views and lets me know you're listening. So thank you all so much for tuning in.
Thank you very much.
Would you like to see mobile home park value add projects in progress? If so, follow us on Instagram @passivemhpinvesting for photos and awesome videos from our recent mobile home park acquisitions. Once again, that's @passivemhpinvesting on Instagram. See you there.